This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Man Bun on a Hot Tin Roof edition. It's Wednesday, June 28th, 2017. On today's show, GLOW stands for Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. It's a 10-part streamer on Netflix, a fictionalized take on the 1980s world of female pro wrestling. And then Lord became a global pop sensation 4 years ago at the age of 16, somewhat incredibly, with the song Royals and an album as good as the song. Her new record, Melodrama, is out, and Carl Wilson has called it the pop album of the year. We will query him as to its merits. And finally, the Ken Doll reboot has lit up the internet. We will discuss. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, and of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steven.
This is the first time the three of us have done a show since we got back from Australia.
Yeah, I'm so excited. Back on American soil. I don't know about you guys, but this is why I wanted to talk about Australia. And plus, I still feel like my brain and body are recovering in a good way from the dazzling wonders of that trip.
Absolutely everything about it was antipodal, right? Like, it's not only that you're, you know, deplaning after 30 hours in the sky to a completely different time zone. It's also, you know, the opposite season, and our show's really popular and beloved there.
Yeah, it's like I was saying to Steve, it's like passing through a portal where we become more interesting going to Australia. We need to do it every year for our own self-esteem. I don't know. I think that could be dangerous.
All right. Well, back to, you know, the banal reality of Eastern Standard Time, in which we're three drab podcasters talking about pop culture. GLOW is an acronym for Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. What was an all-female wrestling show in the 1980s is now a fictionalized behind-the-scenes account of that show. It stars Alison Brie as a self-serious actress who wants to do Strindberg and is just grateful at this point that she's not doing porn. It also stars Betty Gilpin as her washed-up soap star friend, and Marc Maron is the frustrated hack cineast, a B-movie director who is Svengali to the whole operation. Let's listen to a clip.
Ruth Wilder, looked like you.
Yeah, it's a headshot.
Oh, Strindberg. Who the fuck is that?
Oh, it's a
I'm kidding. I know who Strindberg is. I'm not an idiot. So what are you, like a real actor?
Yeah. Done a bunch of plays in Omaha at a little spot called the Blue Barn Theater. I did a film a few years back. I've also done extensive mask work and clowning workshops. How much acting will there be on this show?
As opposed to what?
Hair pulling.
You don't like wrestling?
Well, I don't really know wrestling.
You don't think wrestling is acting?
It's not, is it? It's more like a sport with costumes. Or, sorry, are you hiring actors to play wrestlers, or are we the wrestlers?
Yes.
Which one?
Julia, this is quite an interesting show. What'd you make of it?
I thoroughly enjoyed it and gobbled up five episodes of it, maybe even six. But I have a few quibbles, which I will hold in reserve until I hear what you guys think.
Yeah, I would have to say on balance after three episodes that I will not continue with this show, although I do concede that it's highly entertaining. I can see its addictive properties, and it's got some really interesting casting ideas, like putting Marc Maron in that role as the sleazy developer. But there was some kind of thinness to this show that maybe the three of us can get at together, where I didn't feel like it took place in a richly established world. It felt like everybody had 80s costumes on and was sort of, you know, doing funny 80s things. But I didn't really get a sense of either what the sort of gender politics of the show are, what the social universe is that it takes place in, what these misfit ragtag women who get rounded up to be in Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling have invested in the show, except that they all need jobs. It just didn't seem to take place in kind of the maybe richly textured world that we expect from, I guess, what we're calling prestige television. So I guess this is all ways of saying that it felt a little bit trashy to me, which is, of course, part of the whole point of the show and the enjoyment of the show. So maybe I'm just not getting it.
Oh, man. I have to say that I'm so unhelpfully on the agnostic fence when it comes to, you know, all the relevant questions surrounding GLOW, including Maron's performance. There were moments when I thought he was terrific and that it was an inspired piece of casting, and that he's kind of necessary as the center of the show, almost more than Alison Brie, the sleazeball who would exploit all these women in order maybe to rescue his career. A couple of observations before a judgment, but it seems to me the show speaks to our moment in two pretty obvious ways. The first is that it shares a producer and a lot of DNA with Orange is the New Black, and it kind of answers to this hunger for programming about the dilemmas of would-be empowered women in an interesting way. And it really clearly, I mean, it just has a lot of DNA in common with Orange is the New Black. You know, roster of very desperate, very diverse women whose backstories are going to animate and bulk out the, you know, the run of the series. And the second, I thought, in some ways more interesting thing, because it was less familiar and more poignant, really, to the current moment, is that pro wrestling is a metaphor for our contemporary situation, especially our politics, you know, in which it's impossible to tell the difference. I mean, you hear it in that clip. Maron character refuses to acknowledge a distinction between the real and the fake. And that, it seems to me, they were very in control of that aspect of it, whereas perhaps the, you know, kind of feminist counter-programming, you know, Orange is the New Black aspect of it seemed a little received and possibly even a little stale to me. What struck me as fresh was the aspect of pro wrestling that has always served as a kind of you know, postmodernist looking glass to our political situation. Anyway,
if you guys are both going to cavil so much, I think I'm going to have to come out as a more adamant defender of the show now that I've taken the measure of your esteem for it. But I did share that question whether the diversity and variance among the women who are in the ensemble here was right. Like, it felt a little bit so targeted for our moment and for the desire of the Orange is the New Black producers to find another milieu in which they could recapture the lightning in the bottle of choosing to tell the stories of women whose stories don't typically get told on television, that they may have, like, over diversified the staff beyond the realms of plausibility. But I think actually one of the appeals of the original GLOW was that it was more diverse than the rest of television, both in race and body shape and size. And so I'm not sure the show does a great job exactly explaining why that would be the case, or, you know, whether that was something that Maron director character was looking for. It just had to do with who was willing to be in the show because they didn't have other opportunities or what. But I don't think, as a matter of fact, it's crazy. However, that does point up what my one cavil is about the show, which is there's a bunch of things in it that feel slightly hastily and directly executed, and I'm willing to forgive them because of how charming I think all three of the central performances are, and many of the ensemble performances, but particularly Alison Brie, Betty Gilpin, and I think Marc Maron, whose performance really works for me in this. Like, I'm along for the ride. It's just too fun. It's like perfect summer TV to me. It's fun to watch these women trying out these personas. It's fun to watch them wrestle. And as you get further into the show, you do get more training montages and more wrestling moves and falls and holds and more understanding of how this kind of wrestling works. But there are just a few places where the show kind of dashes past a few points and doesn't fully do the work of subtly setting up its world. And it just doesn't feel quite as fully baked as some of the TV we're used to seeing these days.
All right. Well, let me tell you what I liked about the show. I liked that it was not I liked that it was not as obviously well-written as your now average peak TV television show. And it had a kind of, but in all seriousness, like there's a style of writing now that's so automated and so professionalized and so clever. And it's just writers in a room just knowing how to deliver the setup and deliver the punchline. I thought the show was virtuous for lacking that in a way. It's been so long since I saw anything that had raffish, slightly underbaked charm to it, which is probably the appropriate style to tell this set of stories.
Yeah, it has this, a little bit of a let's put on a show in the barn kind of aesthetic, right? In that it is pre-reality TV days. It's not about high-style, big-business Hollywood and people shaping their personas with professional agents. I mean, it really is about a bunch of normal, everyday, you know, pretty much low-to-middle-income women trying to figure out what they're even doing or what wrestling might possibly be for them. And that slightly, I don't know, kind of bricolage aspect of it has its charm.
Yeah, I think that let's put on a show quality is exactly right, Dana. It's just fun to watch these people putting this thing together. It's fun to, it's almost like watching a bunch of skits and sketches because that's what they're doing. They're kind of testing out these goofy ideas and seeing what's funny and seeing what works. And that kind of process story is always entertaining. And Marc Maron is basically playing himself, like a formerly angry, dysfunctional addict who, is reached a slightly wiser version of himself, which is certainly the persona that he presents on his podcast. But it kind of works in the world. And I also think Alison Brie's performance is fascinatingly different from what I've seen her do before, because she typically plays women with no self-doubt, right? Women of great composure and certainty. Trudy was the unflappable wasp helpmeet in Mad Men. And then her character on Community was maybe not without insecurities, but just so fully vibrantly herself in any moment, didn't have a lot of like anxiety or self-consciousness about presentation, I think. So to see this kind of just really desperate, scrabbling, striving, earnest, it's almost uncomfortable how anxious Alison Brie is in her performance and then how good it makes her feel when she figures out how to be better at this absurd thing. I thought that was really, really terrific.
Mm. All right. Well, the show is Glow. It's on Netflix. We're curiously divided about it, both among ourselves and individually. Internally. So come to facebook.com/culturefest. Tell us what we should think about it. All right, moving on. All right, well, now is the moment in the podcast we talk about business before we proceed any further. Surely we have some. Dana, what do you got?
First of all, Steve, we have an important announcement about our own show, which is that next week, because of the 4th of July holiday, we will be coming out a day later than usual. So there will still be a Culture Gab Fest next week, but it will release on Thursday, July 6th, rather than Wednesday, July 5th. So we'll see you then. Also, we wanted to tell you about another of Slate's podcasts, The Gist with Mike Pesca, Slate's daily podcast on politics and culture. If you've listened to The Gist at all or heard Mike Pesca as a guest on our own show, which he's done many times, you know that he is a unique voice to radio on demand. There's nobody quite like Mike Pesca, and what he puts together every day is really special. This week, Mike will be interviewing Jeremy McCarter, the co-author of Hamilton, A Revolution, and Helen Peterson of BuzzFeed. And also he'll interview Eddie Izzard about his new book. So check The Gist out every weekday afternoon at slate.com/thegist, or you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we should let our listeners know that today in Slate Plus, we're going to be having one of our esprit d'escalier conversations, a conversation where we go back and pick up the missing tidbits from a previous conversation, regrets, questions, things we wish we had talked about. And today's edition will be Esprit d'escalier d'Australie. That is us visiting Australia again and talking about our memories from that very intense and very wonderful trip. This is the first time we've been in the studio all together since the Australia trip. So this has been our first chance to revisit it together. And remember that Slate Plus members will get bonus segments like that for all of your favorite Slate shows, plus ad-free podcasts. If you want to sign up for Slate Plus for free for 90 days, just download our new iOS app at slate.com/app and try all the benefits of Slate Plus free for 3 months. So try it out by going to slate.com/app. All right, Steve, back to the show.
4 years ago, the song Royals turned a 16-year-old New Zealander into a global pop phenomenon. Her name, of course, is Lorde. Now her new record, Melodrama, is here. I'd easily nominate Melodrama as the best pop album of the year so far, perhaps the best we're likely to get, writes Carl Wilson, Slate's wonderful music critic. Carl, welcome to the show.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Those are confident words. Why don't you back them up by picking a track for us to play before we talk?
Okay, why don't we start with The Louvre? I think progresses. I call and you come through. Blow all my friendships to sit in hell with you. But we're the greatest. They'll hang us in the Louvre. Down the back, but who cares? Still the Louvre. Okay, I know that you are not my type. Still I fall. I'm just a sucker. Let you fill her mind. But what about love? Nothing wrong with it. Supernatural. Just moving close to me. Close to you. Feel it close to me. Carl, you love this record. Tell me why. To me, the interesting thing about this album is, you know, Lorde emerged, as you were saying at the top, at 16, 4 years ago, as really this kind of left field kind of fluke hit with Royals, which came along, I think, at a point when sort of pop diva chart pop was at its peak this decade and was sort of the most dominant it's been. And Lorde kind of offered a sort of skeptical rebuttal in some ways to the excesses of pop at the time with this very sort of minimalist electronic sound and this very sort of teenage, almost teenage art manifesto kind of style lyrics, and this very unique voice. And the interesting thing that's happened in the interim is even though she sort of withdrew from the spotlight for a while, she herself, from the strength of that hit, was ushered into the big chart pop realm. And what's emerged with Melodrama is this really interesting hybrid of that kind of art school kid sensibility with a big pop sensibility. And to me, this album is probably a transitional album for Lorde. And I imagine that we'll see a lot more changes from her. She's still just 20. But in some ways, this is kind of a summary of the styles of the past 7 years or so, as well as a really unique take on it. And it's at the same time a really introspective and an individualistic album, and an album that has all of the virtues of big hooks and big scenarios and a real romanticism to it. And I think it's a really unique document.
I mean, that is a tough target to hit, right? Where she kind of maintains her identity as counter-programming to the big pop diva, but also comes out with a big sound radio play record. Talk a little bit about just technically how she does that, because I agree with you. I think she has done it.
I think, yeah. I mean, some of those sort of hallmarks of her style, those kind of crisp, thin keyboards and things, are still there, but they're now layered on in different ways, and her voice is layered in different ways. But there's also sort of added in guitars and pianos and organic drums and things to give it a bigger feel in that way. You know, both her and Jack Antonoff, the producer that she worked with on this in New York, are self-professed big Queen fans, and you can hear that in it as well. It has these moments where it's kind of stretches for a more epic kind of sound. And then also the song structures have evolved. She is using the tricks of modern pop, the pre-chorus and chorus and returns and thematics that people use, but she doesn't use them in the way that you'd expect somebody shooting for the top of the charts would. They tend to take sort of little left turns and little twists in places where they don't go for the complete payoff. And so, yeah, I think it's interesting how she manages to do that technically as well as kind of through her sensibility.
So, Carl, as you say, Lorde is only 20. This is her second album. And in some ways, although it seems like she's denied this in interviews, but it seems to be a breakup album. It's pretty much thematically built around, it seems like, one broken relationship. And she did, I think, although she's very private about it, recently break up with someone. I'm wondering what you think of it in terms of how does it fall in the pantheon of breakup albums, or would you deny that it is one?
I kind of would deny that it's a breakup album. I think it's kind of a heartbreak album, more than it's about the specifics of that relationship. But the other thing is that it's kind of a double-sided concept album, because there is the part about the relationship, but there's also an ongoing thread through it, which is the part that she does talk about more openly, that it's also kind of about being 20 and hanging out with your friends and partying maybe too much. And that she says that she structured the album around the idea of a house party and the stages in the evening of a house party. And clearly it leaves that scenario several times to talk more about the kind of heartbreak side of it. But it's, so to me, it's interesting the way that those two things are woven together. And I think for her, the implication is kind of that they're inseparable, that the relationship happened in a social scene, and that the social scene also kind of maybe reflects some of the things that were wrong with the relationship. Lord has a tendency, kind of one of the unique factors of her writing style, at least at this stage in her life, to speak in the first person plural. On both albums, she's kind of constantly talking about we.
Right, and we can be royals. You're right. She's the royal we.
Yeah, exactly. And and on the first album, that was kind of this grand we of some kind of like teenage underground art movement. And this album, it can be all kinds of things. It can be the couple in the relationship. It can be this group of friends who are maybe going to excesses in the evenings on the weekends. And it can be kind of a Lord and herself kind of we. And it kind of is a moving target in some ways that helps her, I think, shield herself a little bit, but also relates to her willingness to kind of still be speaking for something bigger than herself. In the review, I was joking that, you know, Jack Antonoff is Lena Dunham's boyfriend. And in many ways, Lord does sort of think of herself a la Hannah Horvath as a voice of a generation.
Yeah, there's moments on this album, I have to say, lyrically, where that self-importance got to me a little bit. There's it's called melodrama, right? And in some ways, it's ironic about its own self-dramatizing and about the way that teenage life is all about self-dramatizing. But I don't think Lord yet has quite enough perspective on that life to be aware of the thin line between ironizing about being a drama queen and just being a drama queen.
Yeah, I think that's very perceptive. Although I do think, you know, melodrama definitely puts it in that framework. And in some ways, I think it's kind of a fond farewell to that sensibility. You know, this is sort of her coming into her 20s. And in some ways, I think she wanted to play that up in kind of an affectionate tribute to that mindset. But yeah, there are moments that seem a little less aware of what she's doing.
There were several different moments on the album, and I can point to specific lyrics if we want to listen to them, but moments where I felt like, oh, that was a nice rhyme or that was a nice turn of phrase, and then she milked it too hard. I'm thinking of I think the song is called Sober 2 Melodrama in parentheses. Even the two to me is a little bit pretentious when a song has Roman numeral 1 and Roman numeral 2. But there's a moment in there where she has some nice rhyme about, oh, how fast the evening passes, washing out the champagne glasses. And when I first heard that, I thought, oh, that's a nice little turn of phrase. It's sort of T.S. Eliot-like or something, you know? It sort of reminded me of The Women Come and Go, talking of Michelangelo, this like image of alienation. But then she repeats it about 7 times before the end of the song, and it kind of loses its power.
Yeah, that I had the exact same experience, that exact same line, where I was like, oh, yeah, she's clever. And then I was like, oh, has she got anything else up her sleeve? Come on. This line can't withstand this amount of repetition. I also think, I mean, basically, I'm not sure I could point to a better pop album this year, but I was not in love with this album. And I don't, for me, none of the songs on it achieved the heights of Royals. And I say that as someone who is basically really excited for Lord to keep making music for decades to come, as you know in your review, and to see what else she does. But to me, this album seems a little bit stuck in the world weariness of the extremely young person, which her just incredibly sharp, skeptical, lacerating voice was so surprising coming from where it did and who it did on the first album. Here, it loses a little bit of its surprise. Also, for me, just to my own musical taste, I feel like sonically the album resists giving us a complete pop banger a little bit, even though it's got Jack Antonoff, who's capable of such tricks at her side. Like it's it kind of stays in this sort of ballady, thinky, dreamscape song space. And I just I would have loved one or two that just like gave you the simultaneous joy of being a dance floor pop song and having the world weariness laced through it. And so then without the without that juxtaposition, you just get the world weariness. And some of it to me is quite effective and some of it feels a little affected.
Mm. Yeah, but perhaps the word jejune comes to mind. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you've just asked for two opposite things.
fair to call me out.
And in some ways, I think that is the problem of this album is that it is caught between those things. To me, I think my investment in Lorde ever since that first album has been so complete that I'm pretty happy to be with her in her stages as she goes. And I have a perhaps misplaced faith that this is all leading some really fascinating places. And so I think I partly enjoy the album as a report back on the stages of that. You know, if you think about Pure Heroine, that first album, it was a completely asexual album on many levels. And so, you know, one of the things that's happening here is this somebody coming into their own and experiencing romantic disappointment and all of those things for the first time. And I think there is a freshness to that world weariness still. But one of the most fascinating things, she did an interview a few weeks ago with The Guardian where she, you know, plainly stated that, you know, ultimately her goals are to be up there with, she named Paul Simon and Leonard Cohen and Joni Mitchell. And I think that is where she's going. And I kind of think that this album, you know, Jack Antonoff also worked on Taylor Swift's in 1989, and Taylor Swift has become a good friend of hers. And I think there's almost a little too much Taylor Swift on this album. But to me, that's I'm down with that being part of the stages we see this young kind of incredible artist go through.
I'm completely with Carl on this one. I mean, you know, when you look back to, so she said Paul Simon, Leonard Cohen and Joni fucking Mitchell, which I kind of loved. Yeah. And those are great artists to aspire to. The album often sounds to me a little bit like Lady Gaga meets Kate Bush, which I loved. But what I find plausible about it is that you had this great moment in the early 1970s of kind of singer-songwriter, whatever, authorially driven, very personal diary-like music from people like Joni Mitchell. And I don't think the record company and a lot of intermediaries got between the author of the music and the final product. I mean, maybe that's naivete on my part, but that's my impression. And now you have a kind of very belated facsimile of it, in which a young pop chanteuse is like growing up in public, and they're kind of stages of the cross that strike me as often very calculated and overproduced. I think that she squares that circle. I really do. I think Lorde is some odd midpoint between Joni Mitchell, you know, of the early 1970s of Blue and you know, Hissing of Summer Lawns, and Taylor Swift 1989. I didn't think such a thing was possible, but I completely, you know, on tracks like Homemade Dynamite, I completely buy it.
I feel like she's got a way to go lyrically and musically before she's in Joni Mitchell territory, but it's great that she's aspiring to get there.
You have to remember that when Joni Mitchell was 20, she was playing in cafes and doing this kind of woodshedding off on her own. And if you listen to those first couple of Joni Mitchell albums, there's a lot that's not great shakes on there as well. So there is this effect, you know, Lorde was signed to a record label contract at 13. And so she's going through those stages in a very different way. And perhaps that'll be to her ruination, but I don't think so.
Man, to me, there's another whole conversation to be had here that we can't even get into about the, I would argue, maybe overvalorization of teenage girl experience that's putting so many teenage girls out there as pop products before they've even become people properly. But I was wondering if we could go out on, or if at some point listen to my favorite track, which is maybe the most emo on the whole record, a piano ballad called Liability.
For me, you're a liability. You're a little much for me. So they pull back, make other plans. I understand, I'm a liability. Get you wild, make you leave.
All right, well, Carl, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on to talk about Lord.
I'm so happy to do it.
Because women needed to be afflicted with an impossible standard of male beauty, too, the Ken doll was introduced in 1961 as a counterpart to Barbie. Ever since, his name has been an insult to any man dedicated to bland perfection, especially physical perfection, and to the best of my knowledge, Ken has never once soared even an inch above his banal origins. So, of course, it was inevitable that he would be relaunched, and here he is, or really, here they are. Ken comes now in different shapes and sizes, as well as ethnicities and hairstyles, but he's still always just Ken, a byword for the man who, designed to please everyone, inspires no one, except possibly Twitter. Dana Stevens, which is lit up with memes about Man Bun Ken in particular. Take it away.
Yeah, I was on vacation last week, so I missed the release of Man Bun Ken and all the other new Kens. And then when we started researching this segment and deciding we were going to talk about Ken, I was just treated to this incredible display, a peacock's tail of hilarious Twitter comments on the new Kens. Can I just read you a couple of these really golden Ken tweets?
Oh my God, please. Yes.
Just saw the Man Bun Ken doll ride by me on his longboard with a copy of Infinite Jest. And the Man Bun Ken, if you take a look at him online, you'll see he's very much the sort of Bernie bro of the dolls. Another really great breakdown, and y'all might have seen this one because I think it went really viral, but this tweet breaks down the six different types of Kens, and it's all the better if you're looking at the grid, but I think the words also kind of evoke the images. It says, "Which new Ken are you? Bisexual model, Rachel Maddow, Bernie would have won, 15-year-old app developer, hottest lesbian on Tinder, or Chad?"
I like the idea of a Ken being Chad.
Chad is definitely a Chad, but Rachel Maddow is a perfect call. There's this one Ken who's sort of, a white guy with big, heavy horn-rimmed glasses and a black crew cut, and you can really just imagine him on MSNBC at 9 p.m.
All right, Julia, well, I sort of have to ask you, did you play with Barbie?
I did have a few Barbies. I never had a Ken. I remember the fascination being around the dressing, the like putting on and off of the tulle, the flammable tulle outfits or chiffon or like weird kind of satin on the front and like hard, nubbly plastic on the back seeming flounces. So a lot of clearly visceral, textural memories of Barbie and her clothes. Also, those little plastic snaps that were kind of fiddly and hard to deal with. But I never had a Ken. I never encountered a Ken until I was a babysitter in my teens, babysitting for a young girl who had a ton of Barbies and Kens. And then I would play subversive feminist Barbie babysitter with her, wherein we would do storytelling play, as we learn it is called in the Barbie play style research lab, where she would tell stories of Barbie getting into distress and Ken rescuing her. And then I would always take over the Barbies and Kens and have Ken get like stuck in a witch's cave and the Barbie have to come rescue Ken and say, "Geez, Ken, this cave is really easy to get out of. Why didn't you get out of the cave?" So that's my entire experience with Ken, striving to emasculate Ken for an audience of 1 8-year-old.
Has evolved now into a management technique. I like it. What is it, Julia, do you think about? I mean, I thought the Man Bun Ken, to me, it was like the Zodiac Killer jokes surrounding Ted Cruz. It made me think that the Earth as a planet and the humans as a species are, in fact, redeemable, right? It was like the little candle in the heart of the deepest darkness. And Man Bun Ken, to me, is just so fucking funny. Why is it so funny? Why is it so right? Why is it so timely? Talk me through it.
I don't know that I think it's funny. You seem to think it's ridiculous, maybe. I feel like this is this should be understood as a commercial effort by a large corporation to make its product palatable to the type of parents who, like us, find the social mores of old Barbie gross. It's like too white, too unrealistic, too just old school, and not in keeping with any of our parenting tactics.
Oh, no. I understand the motivations of the Mattel Corporation. I'm asking you why Man Bun Ken memes on Twitter are so timely and funny.
Oh, I don't think they are. I didn't enjoy them very much. I just think the whole thing is like stupid and ignorable. I mean, I basically feel like it's a social good that, that these dolls are getting updated and that like the purchasing power of a new generation of parents is generally, and not universally, but trending less retrograde than previous generations. Yeah. And so why make fun of Man Bun Ken? I mean, I don't really understand. The thing that is the fundamental question here is, or the thing that would be truly radical, I think, and that I would criticize about my own parenting is to really make dolls a thing for boys. And like I'm sure plenty of boys play with dolls and my guys have evinced some interest in them, but like, I don't know. It's built into me. Like when they evince interest in dinosaurs or trains, we get them dinosaur and train stuff. But like the one time they like fed a bottle to a doll at a playgroup, I didn't go out and get them a bunch of dolls. They have like little stuffed animals. They take care of the stuffed animals. They tell storytelling about, you know, feeding and the, you know, like they do all the kind of caretaking stuff that they see me and their dad do for them and other people who love them in their lives. But, you know, that to me... The radical thing in child rearing would be to foster that kind of caretaking play in the imaginative space of young boys, more so than in the representation of who is getting taken care of. And that's where I think Barbie is a different kind of doll. Like the distinction between what a Barbie doll is and what a baby doll is kind of comes into play. Because I think the radical steps are more to be made in the baby doll play area. The Barbie doll thing is about imagining a fantasy grown-up life. And that's why Ken is an accessory, because if you're a young girl, like the whole story is, oh, what are you going to be? And what's your job going to be? And what are your outfits going to be like? And, you know, you're going to go on dates and you might have a dream wedding and all that stuff. But like, you don't actually, you know, you're not actually romantically interested in anybody. Mm-hmm. You're only interested in the notion of it. So to me, I don't know, like, yay, but who cares is my response to Man Bun Ken.
Well, I guess so. But Dana, it seems to me that in her incisive commentary, Julia's slowly approaching what's interesting here, which is that, you know, there's
how incisive
something
can it be if I only approached it slowly?
Exactly right. But it, which
damn,
is that
damn you, Steve.
There's something about Dana, right? Like you and I both find Man Bun Ken, but like just like bottomlessly funny, right? Like
yes.
I laughed for hours.
And I will, okay. I will defend that to the death, that Man Bun Ken and his cohorts are hilarious.
All right, so let's raise to the surface of consciousness and self understanding what we find so fucking funny about it. Doesn't it have something to do with a? It implies that probably the really graceful way to accept the new feminist moment as men is to accept that you're this horrible, barbarous, primitive, atavistic, now useless holdover from a previous era and just fucking fess up to it. right? As opposed to pretending to, you know, a kind of woke feminism underneath which is all the same old impulses, which is to mansplain, dictate terms, and elevate, you know, white maledom as the default human.
Well, I mean, part, of course, of the array, part of the point of this whole new array of new Kens is that they're not all white. There's one that seems to be kind of mixed race. There's one that seems to be African-American. The Rachel Maddow doll might be an Asian Ken. I'm not completely sure. There's also a range of body types, which is something that's happened a while ago in Barbie type dolls, but that hasn't really happened in male action figures. So in the very era where, as we talked about on this show in relation to Baywatch, when the ideal male body is getting more and more impossible to obtain and impossible overcut and all of that, there's now the broad Ken doll, who also happens to be the one with a man bun. And if you look at his entire body, I mean, he's I guess supposed to be an average shape. He's not an impossible sort of athletic shape. He's a little bit wider. Oh, this is such a silly conversation. I mean, I guess to me, let me defend just the importance of laughing at the new six models. Or I keep saying six, which is the number of images that seem to have been released in a grid to the public. But I think there's going to be more, even more body and hair and style types than that. But what is Mattel attempting to do in designing these various multiracial, multi-sized, multi-hair styled Kens? It's trying to reimagine masculinity, right? For apparently little girls, but maybe little boys as well. well, for children anyway, different ideas of what masculinity could do. And I think maybe part of the humor for you and me, Steve, is that new array is still so narrow and so ridiculous that there's still something so emasculated and kind of clown-like about these six mm-hmm. representations of masculinity. I think that maybe the absurdity comes in the fact that, you know, in this moment when femininity and feminism and all of these things are being redefined and discussed and they're so out there in the Twitter sphere, masculinity is something that, you know, is completely in crisis and completely in question as to what its future right. should be. And these dolls right. kind of perform that.
Yes, I agree. But I think what's what's funny is that Man Bun Ken was immediately weaponized by Twitter to make fun of Bernie Bros, right? That's the object of the satire of Man Bun Ken right now. I mean, some of it is making fun of the doll and making fun of Mattel, but most of it is making fun of this kind of would-be new sensitive man who, underneath this kind of thin layer of woke feminism and kind of strategically deployed self-eunuch making, is actually a white, heterosexual, heterosexist man who still wants to be dominant and on top. And it seems to me that is a very rapier satire and was very clever. And the speed with which the hive mind of Twitter happened upon it just strikes me as miraculous.
Ugh, I do not buy this argument at all. Somehow you guys are making me, you've made me decry Glow, a show I sincerely enjoyed and love. And now you're making me defend Man Bun Ken. But here I am. I don't think it matters if, I mean, first of all, sure, some people used the existence of Man Bun Ken to make fun of insufficiently progressive men who think they are more progressive than they are. Fine. Such people are worth making fun of. What a useful tool. But I think it's, I don't know. I think that Man Bun Ken is an admirable step forward for society, I will say. And I think it doesn't matter if a corporation is cynical in its motives. Like, what's heartening here is they did the market research, and the market research showed them that too many Americans think old, white, heteronormative Ken is lame, and they want more different Kens. And of course, Ken is just always going to be ludicrous because his personhood is the same as like a plastic Barbie briefcase. Like, he can never be more than an accessory. But it is a modest step forward for society that Mattel believes, that we believe, that Barbie should have more options in her Ken, just as she has long had options in, choosing whether to wear a fur-covered mule or a sensible cap-toe pump.
Is she driving the pink Jeep? Or is she getting in the green glittery motorcycle?
But like, these dolls are powerful for all that they seem ridiculous to us. That's part of why so many people have objected to them for so long. And it's like a modest step forward that the imaginations of a bunch of young people will be slightly broader than they were before.
Oh, Julia, I have to say, I marvel at your ability to say brilliant things while fundamentally misunderstanding the premise of this segment. the purpose of Man Bun Ken was to make fun of me, and somehow we've strayed off topic.
I don't want to make fun of you, Steve. I want to protect and shelter you and pop you in a pink Jeep.
Can I also just point out
I come pre-castrated, Julia. There's nothing you can do to there's nothing you could do to add to that, your immense gelding powers notwithstanding, Julia. All right, tell us what you think of this ridiculous segment at facebook.com/culturefest. I thought we were talking about the Man Bun meme, and Julia thought we were talking about corporate mores. And as always, Dana was the center of common sense gravity. All right, moving on. All right, well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Steven, my endorsement this week is related to Pride Weekend, which I missed being any part of because I was on vacation with my family in a place that was too remote for Pride to be displayed except by pine trees. And that's a weekend that I hate to miss in New York because it always sort of feels like the official beginning of summer and everybody's out and it's beautiful and anyway, it was a particularly important feeling pride this year because it was the first under the Trump administration, obviously. And then by chance, that on that weekend that I wasn't in town, we got an email from a listener that was complaining that our show is essentially sold out to gay interests, I guess because we had a lesbian on the show last week as one of the guest hosts. I'm not quite sure what got this guy fired up, but he was basically saying, "Why are you in the pocket of big gay?" To which our producer answered him with a very smart sort of statistical breakdown of the content of our shows over the last year and the hosts that we've had, and essentially came up with the number that we're about 5% gay, which is significantly less than the actual portion of the population that is LGBTQ. So anyway, I just feel like in response to that guy and in response to having missed Pride, I need to queer up the show by some percentage in my endorsements today. So I'm going to endorse three people on Twitter who don't necessarily tweet about gender and sexuality issues at all, but are either transgender or gay tweeters who are just wonderful people that I follow for their funny writing and their political insights. And some of them are writers in other places. Some of them I really only know as excellent tweeters. But here are the three of them. One of them is named Gabe Ortiz. I believe he writes for Daily Kos on a regular basis, but he's just really fun to follow on anything at all. And his handle on Twitter is Tusk, all caps, T-U-S-K-81. That's Gabe Ortiz. I also follow a wonderful transgender tweeter, just very funny, smart woman named Parker Malloy. And she goes by her own name, P-A-R-K-E-R-M-O-L-L-O-Y. And thirdly, and this is only for somebody who likes threads, because she's one of those people who will do like long, ranty threads, which I really enjoy when the person is good at it. But this third woman is Alexandra Erin, and she also goes under her own name. So Alexandra and then E-R-I-N. And really, those are just sort of plucked from the Twitter sphere, because there are plenty of other great LGBTQ tweeters that I follow. But yeah, if you, like that guy who complained about our show, feel that, you know, somehow LGBTQ issues are overrepresented on this show or in your life, get with the program and start getting to know some people in the world that is so foreign to you. And maybe you'll start to see that the representation is what it's all about.
Dana Stevens in the pocket of big gay. Sad. Julia, what do you have?
I would like to pull a Steve here and endorse something remote but awesome. But not that remote and well worth visiting. I took my sons, I was on vacation last week. Thanks, Steve, for holding down the podcast fort. And my husband and I took our sons to Mass Mocha on a day of wild, ravaging thunderstorms in western Massachusetts. And so we're inside these huge, massive concatenation of barns filled with amazing Technicolor art with pounding rain on tin roofs overhead. And it is a great museum, which I remembered from the time I visited before, maybe 15 years ago, but B, I think an even better museum than it was when it first opened, and C, a really great museum for kids. There's just like enough room for them. It's big enough that you're not like constantly pulling them back and trying to get them not to bump into something or touch the art. And then they have this wonderful kid space room that has a special installation, a piece of art that's designed for kids to like interact with and run through. I think they change it up fairly often. And then little lunchbox art projects that the kids can take and make art that imitates the work they've just seen. So we spent a ton of time in a building full of Saul LeWitt installations, and then did a Saul LeWitt art kit where the kids got to, you know, make lines and stripes and Technicolor projects. And so anyway, Mass Mocha, if you're within a like 2-hour drive of it on any of your jauntings this summer, take the detour and go check it out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just have to come in right behind that endorsement and double down on it. I mean, it is really one of the great art destinations in America, or really even the world. It is a cradle to grave appropriate experience. I mean, my kids are now 14 and 11. They love Mass Mocha. They've loved it their whole lives. I couldn't love it more. And in fact, what you've done is you've happily perturbed me into a slightly different endorsement than I was going to do. But there's a version of Mass Mocha exists in Tasmania, Australia, which is where I went after we were in Melbourne. And so as one of my endorsements, I want to say, yes, it is preposterously far to get to Tasmania. But if you are in Melbourne, if you've made it that far, it's about a 45-minute in the air flight to get to Hobart, Tasmania, where you will find not only a kind of interestingly underdeveloped facsimile of Sonoma, you know, or parts of California, like from the 1950s or 60s. I mean, before kind of everyone discovered it was paradise north of San Francisco. I mean, kind of rolling hills and Pinot Noir grapes and unbelievable produce and people doing their own thing. I mean, Tasmania is truly one of the most remarkable places I've ever visited in my life. But you'll also find a museum that's about 10 years old called MONA, the Museum of Old and New Art, which is sort of like Massmocha. It's a kind of monumental semi-industrial space that they built actually underground beneath an existing vineyard in kind of a concrete bunker. And the integration of art, monumental installation with the space is remarkable. But go to Tasmania, just don't spoil it when you go. And the other thing I want to endorse this week is a band called Always. It's pronounced Always, Always, whatever, but it's spelled with a W. It's spelled with two V's, A-L-V-V-A-Y-S, which is reminiscent of Chiverches, another band that I like, and they're not totally dissimilar. A bewitching female vocalist and kind of echoey, reverby pop backing track. But they're a little bit more rock and roll and indie rock and roll maybe than Chiverches is. But anyway, so they have an unbelievably great, catchy tune called Marry Me, Archie. They're about to come out with, from about 2014, a Canadian band from Toronto. They're about to come out with a new record from which they've released a single called In the Undertow, which is fantastic too. I think you people will like this music, so check it out. Thank you, Dana.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks, Julia.
Thanks, Stephen.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest, and you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Daniel Schrader. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. And the managing producer of Slate Podcast is June Thomas. And above them all, hovering, is the poobah, Andy Bowers. He's the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. Culture Gabfest is part of that network. And you can check out an entire roster of really terrific shows at panoply.fm. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll see you soon.